welcome to episode 108 of the Golf Talk Podcast, brought to you by thesandtrap.com. This is Eric Barseski. Alan Olson is on location, but it's still cold.
The lovely city of Omaha, where it was 10 on Sunday, and it'll be 61 on Thursday.
Oh.
Bonus.
Tiger Woods made his return, and it didn't last all that long.
Yeah, no bonus for Tiger. You know, he's got a 32-6 career record in Accenture Match Play, and Tim Clark took him out behind the woodshed.
Yeah, now it's 32-7.
There again, it's a no-lose situation. He comes back, he gets to play a little bit, he's done, and, I'm sure the execs at NBC were jumping out windows.
Yeah, even the Golf Channel, they had Friday's play without Tiger. I didn't watch much of the weekend play. I watched a little bit of Sunday and a little bit of Saturday, so I'm not sure how much they overdid the Tiger in absentia coverage, but I'm sure it was there. The funny thing to me, and I watched, you know, his first two holes, he was 300 par with almost tap-ins for birdie and eagle. And I was like, oh my God, you know, the world is in for some hurting.
Yeah.
And then he kind of struggled to close out a guy that couldn't make a birdie. And then, of course, lost to Tim Clark. But then he says, after the round, I just didn't make enough birdies. I was pleased with the way I hit the ball for 2 days. I had one bad 8-iron and one bad drive. The bad drive was out of bounds on that drivable par 4 15th hole that basically cost him the match. Tim is a wonderful player, blah, blah, blah. You know, I don't know about you, but I saw a lot more than one bad 8-iron and one bad drive. Tiger was missing greens with wedges and short irons. He was missing fairways with a 3-wood. These aren't narrow fairways. They're fairly generous. I can't count the number of times he was hitting out of a fairway bunker, but it was several.
Yeah, he must really have selective memory or just blocks out most everything. But yeah, I mean, he sprayed it as much as Tiger does spray it. And yeah, I mean, there's lots of shots where he was in the middle of the fairway and you expect him to stick it close, and he wasn't. I mean, he'd miss the green.
And roll 30 yards away because of the slant. Yeah, and I don't know how much of that. It seems weird to me, too, now in retrospect, that he would choose a tournament that's high-altitude tournament. Your yardages are all screwed up.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it seems like a weird tournament to come back to. I think the Accenture part of it had more to do with it than necessarily some of the other, or some people gave credit to early on. I get that match play is like a final round Sunday every day, but he only got two of those, so.
Yeah.
He's only guaranteed one of them, so I don't know if I buy that argument.
Yeah, it was, you know, kind of an odd, you know, if it wasn't for Accenture, he, you know, it's a course he, you know, nobody had ever played before, and yeah, you know, high altitude golf, way different for him, and it just seemed kind of odd. He only can recount two shots. I think it's quite a few more than that, and I don't know.
Yeah,
pretty interesting.
Maybe this will be similar to when he returned. In his own admission, a bit too early after his father's death, missed the cut at the U.S. Open, and then pretty much won like the next 12 straight tournaments he was in, including two majors.
Right.
Maybe it'll be like that, because he does have two more events, and this expands 2 to 3. He has 50 by playing in this. He gave himself 50% more tournaments to play in prior to the Masters. So there's some importance there. It's just the high altitude thing seemed a little weird to me, especially with the number of greens he missed.
Yeah, it was. And you know, like I talked about earlier about NBC and their execs and Golf Channel. I mean, and after two rounds, all the top-seeded guys were knocked out. I mean, there was just a lot of the big names were just goodbye for the weekend. So
yeah,
couldn't have been too happy with that.
Yeah, Phil Mickelson was one of those. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, he barely made it out of Wednesday, so bye-bye.
Jeff Ogilvie did win. He had a solid week. When Jeff Ogilvie won the last time at the match play, he went on to win that 2006 U.S. Open that we just talked about when Phil Mickelson fell apart. Barely made it out of Sunday. Didn't make it out of Sunday.
I see a trend.
It happened once before. It's not going to happen necessarily again. But Jeff Ogilvie has now won twice this year, including the limited field, both limited field events, the Mercedes and now the WGC. It's his third WGC event, too, since he won at Doral last year.
Yeah, I mean, extremely impressive. But after you see his match play record of 17-2, I mean, you kind of expect him. I mean, if he would have got knocked out, I think that would have been a pretty large upset. So he owns the event with Tiger. He's been in the final three of the last 4 years. I didn't watch too much of the final 36 holes in the same day. It's kind of boring. But he pretty much went out there and crushed his buddy. So
yep, both.
He was 11 under through the first 27 holes and had a 6-up lead at one point.
Coasted from there, yeah. If you were paying attention to golf at all this weekend, there's still a good chance you didn't know that there was an alternate field event. The Mayakoba Classic is the alternate field event to the WGC match play. Mark Wilson walked away with a win. I watched some of the round. Saturday and Sunday, he never really was threatened. Kevin Na fell apart after a 62 in the second round on Saturday. Nobody really challenged Mark Wilson seriously. So, congratulations, but as is usual on this show, eh.
Yeah, you get the eh award.
Good job, but yeah. Eh.
Exactly.
Congratulations, you beat nobody in the top 64.
Yeah.
You know, still tough to do, but what have we called it in the past? Glorified nationwide tour field?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you did have a few big names. You know, you had David Toms, Rich Beam, Jerry Kelly. Those guys all tied for sixth.
See, now, Jerry Kelly and David Toms are your big names. And Rich, and Rich Beam. I mean, David Toms a little more than the other two, but...
Yeah.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back with our forum topic of the week after this.
On a scorecard, all shots are created equal.
Stroke is a stroke.
And from the first tee to the 18th green,
there's only one piece of equipment
I use for every one of them.
My golf ball.
And in a game where just one shot can decide a championship,
the ball you play
makes a difference.
Makes a difference.
And that's why
there's only one ball I'd ever play.
That's why there's only one ball
I'd ever play.
Performance counts. Quality counts. Every shot counts. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Well, our forum topic of the week is brought to us by Doug Golfer, and he wants to know who's going to win the 2009 Masters. And he asked for a list of five, and he can, I think he can pretty much go with a list of one, and his name is Tiger.
T-I-G-E-R. That's my list of five. W-O-O-D-S.
There you go. There you go.
That's my alternate list of five. See, P-H-I-L doesn't fit.
No.
You know, G-E-O-F-F, maybe? I don't know. He's the hot pick right now, but he's never played that well. No top 15s in 3 years at Augusta. So, contrary to some, I'm not quite going with Jeff Ogilvy yet.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. You know, we're up to, at the time of this recording anyway, about 4 pages worth of picks, and you know, obviously Tiger's up there, and everybody seems to be riding the Jeff Ogilvy train right now, and, you know, I think Anthony Kim's definitely got a shot at it, and other than that, I don't know. I mean, the last couple of years, you've...
We don't even know what the course setup is like at this point.
No.
They've been rumored to make some changes. They added some yardage to the fronts of tees, which means the course can play shorter when bad weather hits. Like, the first hole has gotten unreal recently with the lack of roll and some things like that. They may have cut down some trees. They may have shaved some of the rough. We don't know. We won't know till Masters Week starts, so it's really tough to say.
Yeah, if it's the Masters of several years back before they turned it to the U.S. Open, it could be fun. If it's the U.S. Open, then it becomes just...
It's funny, too, because, you know, we joke about how the Masters used to be the tournament that Tiger could most win, and the U.S. Open would be the tournament he would least often win. And now that the U.S. Open has become almost a bit more fun, Tiger wins that on a bum knee and can't win a Masters lately.
Yeah, that is a good point. That is that's pretty interesting.
And, you know, given that the U.S. Open is at Bethpage this year, he might be the favorite to win. He might be a better favorite to win at the U.S. Open than the Masters.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, he's still the favorite in either, but he might be a bigger favorite in the U.S. Open this year. And that's just a little weird.
You wouldn't expect that. You definitely expect that the number one tournament for him always is going to be Augusta.
Yeah, and for a guy that was predicted to win 10 or more by Jack Nicklaus, I think, he's still stuck at four. Stuck at four, you know, with all the sarcasm and winking and nudging that you can throw at it, but still.
Yeah. Well, I think Jack also made that prediction before the changes, which are...
He also made that prediction when he was in a generous mood. Before Tiger actually got close to, you know, getting 14 majors. I think I said last week 13, but I meant to say 14. It's 14. Jack's not quite so willing to dish out the compliments now that the kid has more than one major. So.
And is bagging on his greens, but, you know.
Right. We'll be right back after this.
The most important shot is the one you're about to hit. A shot on Thursday is every bit as critical
as one on Sunday afternoon.
In competition,
one shot can be the difference.
The difference it takes to win.
That's why the ball you play
makes a difference.
So the question isn't, why do I play tightest?
But rather,
why would I play anything else?
Why would I play anything else?
Performance counts. Quality counts. Every shot counts. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Welcome back. This week in Beating Balls, we have three quick topics. The tour is out. Another sponsor. The economic climate that we all face. Blah, blah, blah. FBR is out as the title sponsor as of 2010. at the Phoenix Open. Don't know what it'll be called after that. Maybe it'll be the Phoenix Open.
That would be nice. Let's go back to the Phoenix Open, not have all these crazy sponsorship names. Yeah, if you're a bank or a car company, yeah, your days of sponsoring golf tournaments are pretty much over. FBR is out after 2010. U.S. Bank's out in Milwaukee. Ginn's out. The fine folks at Stanford Ponzi Scheme, they're out at Memphis, even though they signed up, I think, till 2016 or something weird like that. Yeah, it's...
Yeah, if you don't have money, just sign... Oh, we'll sponsor this tournament through 2078. There you go. Tim, when we declare bankruptcy, go ahead and sue us.
Exactly. Stay in the line with everybody else.
Right. Good luck with that.
Yeah.
The second story we have is about the Charlotte event. Of course, Wachovia was bought out by Wells Fargo, so it'll be getting a new name.
The Quail Hollow Championship. Doesn't that just ring nicely?
So they're not putting Wells Fargo in now. That's a little weird.
Well, Wells Fargo doesn't want to take the heat like everybody else does and, you know, have all the fine folks up in Washington rip them for taking TARP money and sponsoring golf tournaments.
Yeah, which gets a little silly. I mean, as a business, you still have to advertise.
Well, it's the best advertising for some of these companies that they can do. You know, you sponsor a golf tournament and you hobnob with people. And I mean, this is, it's just ridiculous. All the garbage that
comes along with the TARP money.
Oh, yeah. It's ridiculous. So I think Wells Fargo is looking at trying to give it back. Northern Trust is looking to give their money back.
Yeah, from what I understand, it, a lot of, like, Northern Trust is a successful bank. They're profitable. They didn't want money. They were kind of forced to take it so that they could say, see, we're giving it to successful companies, too. But then there's a penalty if they pay it off within the first 3 years. But while they have the money, they're under all these strict guidelines, despite the fact that they didn't really need it.
Yeah, it's just, it's the hypocrisy of Washington. You've got a company that's actually making money. Maybe we should follow their business model and how they're doing it, and maybe quit ragging on them so much for sponsoring the golf tournament, which, oh, by the way, a ton of money goes to charity.
Right. Yeah, I was going to mention that point as well. Also good. Read the stories.
But hey, speaking of politics, or at least lawyers.
Yeah.
Titleist V. Callaway, you have round 78. Are we up to like round 100 by now? I think I've read they've been in court for more than 2 years going face to face. So when they come,
just on the last one, yeah.
Yeah, so when these guys come in, is it kind of like Cheers where they walk in and they go, Norm, you know? Hey,
right.
I'm beginning to wonder. I mean, they've got to be good buddies by now. I have no idea. I mean.
And how's the joke go? Only the lawyers get rich?
Yeah.
Something, I don't know. I forget the joke, but that's the punchline, I think. So the short version is, as I understand it, and again, I-A-N-A-L, I'm not a lawyer. Callaway sued Titleist because last year's balls, and maybe the ones prior to that, infringed on some patents that they had got when they bought Top Flight. Shortly after the U.S. Patent Office ruled all four of those patents invalid, somehow, the court that it was in said, yep, they infringe, so you have to pull your product. You can't sell those products anymore, which wasn't a big deal for Titleist because they changed over how they built the balls in September or something to no longer be within the scope of the patents, which, again, were previously ruled invalid. So that Titleist appealed that decision. So that thing is still going on.
Round one.
And it seems like it would be an obvious win for Titleist since the patent office ruled finally, meaning they're not going to review it anymore, that the patents are invalid. So I don't know how the court ruled the way they did, but again, I'm not a lawyer. So that was, so far as we know, round one in recent history. Round two is now Callaway is suing Titleist saying that the current balls infringe, and Titleist on the same day filed a lawsuit saying that Callaway's Tour I and Tour IX balls violate, I think, 11 Titleist patents. Titleist said, as the industry leader, we respect the valid intellectual property of others and expect others to respect ours. We believe that disagreements like these are best dealt with between the companies involved. They were in talks with Callaway about the Callaway balls possibly infringing on Titleist. Those broke down, so they sued. We're hopeful these matters can be resolved, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, it does seem kind of odd for, for the round two version of the 2009 balls. How can you just, I mean, they've been out for what, a month? Not even a month. How can you already say they violate? I don't understand how they can.
I don't understand a whole lot of it. I think, whatever. I think, I've seen so many computer patents that just make no sense that I think the patent office is implicit in this. You know, you can patent one click. You can patent, you know, as a way of buying something. You can patent, the stuff you can patent these days is beyond ridiculous. So part of me, as much as I want to blame all the lawyers, part of me wants to just blame the patent office and say, you guys are granting too many patents for too many stupid things that, you know, without doing any research into prior art, because, you know, you can't just email a company and be like, hey, Callaway filed this patent for this. Do you guys have anything like this that you've done before today? Because, you know, every other company would be like, here it is. See?
We are patenting the four-piece ball.
Right, yeah. Who knows?
I'm surprised
somebody hasn't patented a white golf ball or any shade of white, you know? So I want to blame the patent offices.
Yeah, between the patent office and the lawyers.
The whole patent as a way of making money is it's gotten ridiculous. It's gotten out of hand.
It is. And the other thing, too, is that if Callaway is saying that Titleist is violating all these patents and back and forth, then you would think that their ball would be theoretically as good, same, no difference, close.
I don't know. Doesn't have hexagonal dimples. That's all I know.
I don't know.
Plus, Phil doesn't play Titleist anymore, so that's reason enough to use those.
Ooh, yeah. Exactly. We're just
picking on Phil. I was low on my picking on Phil quota for the week.
I was going to say you've kind of laid off the poor chap this week. So
they're all good balls. Whatever, pick the one you like. What about does it? Of course, pick the one that advertises with us if you want. That would be okay too.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah. That does it for episode 108 of the Golf Talk Podcast. Check the show notes posted Wednesdays for the links to the stories we've talked about. Comment on the forum discussion of the week if you'd like. For Alan Olson, this is Eric Brzezinski saying, don't take my idea for white golf balls. I'm going to go patent that right now.
Not if I get there first.